So I'm Ralph Metzner. I'm a professor here at the California Institute of Integral Studies. I teach consciousness studies and ecological consciousness, eco-psychology. I'm also a psychotherapist. And I do workshops and trainings and different parts of the countries and international. My most recent activity that I'm developing is a program in alchemical divination practices. The perceived limitations to the humanistic psychology, which is sometimes considered the third force, and then transpersonal would be the fourth force. The first two being behaviorism and psychoanalysis. When I went to graduate school, which was at Harvard in the late 50s, early 60s, those were the two main schools of psychology that were represented. Behaviorism, Skinnerian, very hardcore behaviorism, and psychoanalysis, but two very different schools of thought. They even had different buildings on campus. Abraham Maslow developed the humanistic psychology approach. He and others, like Carl Rogers and so forth, feeling that, first of all, behaviorism didn't deal with your inner life at all, and then psychoanalysis only focused on pathology and neurotic behavior and not normal people. So then the humanistic psychology, which sort of fit with the humanistic psychology movement and things like the Esalen growth psychology idea, was ideas such as self-actualization, actualizing your hidden potentials, and self-actualization therapy, having complete unconditional regard for the other human being that you're doing therapy, not regarding them as a patient. Or see, traditional experimental psychology, which I was trained in, and it's always the doctor-patient or the experimenter-subject. Those are both what people would call asymmetrical power relationships. And I had one of my teachers at Harvard was Timothy Leary. And before he even got involved in psychoactive mushrooms and substances, he was very strong on this kind of fresh, very egalitarian approach to, he called it existential transactionalism. So treating people as equals, you know, with respect rather than telling them what they should do or shouldn't do. Humanistic psychology movement grew out of that attempt to look at ordinary people and how they developed, and studies of the life cycle and things like that. And then after a while, there was a humanistic journal and an association, and then after a while, Maslow and others, and like Stan Grof and Anthony Suttig, also realized that even that wasn't going far enough, and that you really needed something to cover, to deal with the areas beyond the normality. In other words, and Maslow wrote a book about peak experiences. And then there were, around that same time, people started working with consciousness-expanding drugs, so they're called consciousness-expanding drugs, that basically, now some people use them as adjuncts to psychotherapy dealing with neurotic problems, but other people felt there's other uses that seem to go into dimensions of what ordinarily in the past would have been considered the psychology of religion. You know, William James, 1901, he wrote a book called Varieties of Religious Experience. Religious experience. So Maslow and Grof and others felt they needed a new approach was needed to deal with areas beyond the normal that are not pathological, but touch into areas of religion, mysticism, higher states of consciousness, the kinds of things that Eastern philosophy deals with a lot. And when I was working with Leary and Alpert at Harvard, and other graduate students as well in psychology, you know, it was very clear after working with these substances for a while that that were called psychedelic or mind manifesting, that the ordinary psychology suddenly Freudian depth psychology was completely inadequate. Behaviorism didn't even come close. There is no behavior to observe. And we did do this one study that was Leary's idea because, in terms of the colleagues, he said we can bring about behavior change and by working, giving the psychedelic drugs to prisoners and a convict, convicts in a prison. And then there would be a behavioral index of change would be the recidivism rate, if there's a change in the recidivism rate. We'd look at, other tests and so forth, and interviews, but also that would be a behavioral index, make the behaviorist happy and so forth. Didn't quite work out that way because it's much more complicated to bring about changes in behavior that can be maintained. You may have to have a whole social support system. But that was the idea. But the focus was on states of consciousness. I would say I use the language of consciousness studies as a field within psychology, equally as I do transpersonal psychology. The reason for that, because consciousness, the area of consciousness, is a little bit of a stepchild or in psychology, because psychology, as part of the scientific worldview, even say as a social science within a social paradigm, there's not really that much study of consciousness, because the mainstream scientific paradigm is a materialistic, mechanistic science view. So people, there's dozens of innumerable books about consciousness that are published every year. They all address basically the question, how can we explain consciousness in terms of the brain? In other words, or we could make computer models or information theory, cybernetics, and all this kind of, and brain studies. And I'm not saying that's not appropriate, but I've come to think, and I think along with most other people in the field of transpersonal or consciousness studies, that that approach has its own inherent limitation. William James, interestingly enough, was far ahead of his time and even our time. And I've come to understand because William James had something that he called radical empiricism. That it was kind of the, you could, I now think it's really the appropriate epistemology for the study of consciousness. Because it says, well, it has two parts. The empirical part is all knowledge must be based on observation, on experience. That's what empiricism means. You don't get, there has to be some observation, some data that you make. And all science accepts that. You don't get knowledge by just sitting around fantasizing, making things up. You get something, but you don't get true knowledge that you can work with. Radical empiricism was, and it was truly radical, even in William James's time, and even now, that no experience is excluded from becoming part of knowledge. And ordinary science doesn't do that. Ordinary science excludes certain realms of experience right away. For example, the way it deals with drug experiences, it says, oh, well, that's a drug effect. It puts it in the category of like drugs, like heart drugs and mind drugs. So, there's no true knowledge there. It's just a drug effect. And you go, oh, hallucinations, hallucinogenics, it produces hallucinations. Hallucinations to most people means illusions. So, not scientific. Religious experience is the same thing. Religious experience is not scientific because you can't basically study anything consciousness because there's nothing to see, nothing to observe, nothing to measure. Science wants to have it be measurable, observable. William James says, with radical empiricism, no phenomena are excluded. For example, also parapsychological phenomena. See, all is excluded from science, even although they make observations, which are statistically valid, by the same criteria, even. Like J.B. Ryan did all these experiments on parapsychology, but the scientists know. They said, a priori, from ideological grounds, we exclude that, because it can't possibly be true. And that, to me, and to William James, is not scientific. The scientific approach, the radical empirical approach, would be open to any kind of experience, and it doesn't exclude any observations based on preconceptions. And what makes it scientific is not where the observations come from, but what you do with them afterwards. In other words, you can make objective observations in your own consciousness. And that's why you have to do it in your own consciousness. And in fact, this is also why it ties into Eastern psychology, because in Eastern psychology they have these practices of meditation. In a meditation, you're making systematic observations that have been accumulated and written down by yogis and meditators and mystics over the years, and they say, you know, you do this meditation, you may have this kind of experience, and you do this one, you may have this, and then it's these steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, like a very systematic, very scientific, over centuries, a phenomenal database. So, and William James himself was completely open. He looked at, well, let's look at mystical experiences. Mm-hmm. You don't dismiss it. Mainstream science and sort of mainstream conception, mysticism is sort of misty. You know, it's kind of vague, right? If you look up in the dictionary, that's one of the definitions. It's something misty, vague. It's the opposite. See, the mystics themselves say, not at all, I'm sorry. You know, the mystic, when I had that experience, whether drug-induced or not, I had more certain knowledge than I do ordinarily. It's universal among mysticism. That's the first thing. It's certain knowledge. It doesn't come through the usual senses. And William James, he studied parapsychological experiments. Somnambulism, hypnotism, all kinds of unusual experiences. He studied psychedelic experience. He took nitrous oxide. And he said, he had an amazing quoting. He said, I took nitrous oxide and that those experiments have convinced me that no account of human consciousness, all around our ordinary consciousness, separated by the filmiest of screens, like other realms of reality. And no account of human consciousness that leaves these other realms out of account can be considered complete. What you experience is a function of your set and your setting, the set and the setting. The set being the internal expectations and belief systems that you bring to it, and the external environment in which you find yourself. And one of the classes I teach here at the Institute is where I use that general idea to look at all kinds of altered states of consciousness, including, for example, the ordinary states of consciousness that we're all familiar with, which we're very familiar. See, some people don't like the term altered states because they think it's automatically pathological or abnormal in some way. But I say alterations of consciousness that are completely normal couldn't be more normal, because every day, every 24 hours, we cycle through sleeping and waking. That's an altered state, very profound altered state, which is thinking, feeling, perception, everything is completely different. Different laws of time and space, everything is different. Because self-concept, everything is different, just like you've taken a drug. And sometimes you did take a drug, a sleeping drug, or a wake-up pill. You know, so. But we cycle through them, it's very normal. And then you can have other sort of meditative states. In fact, in India, Indian psychology, they recognized 4 different classical normal altered states of consciousness. They had a waking state, sleeping without dreams, and sleep with dreams, which they identified as 2 separate states. And then they had a 4th state they called the 4th state was kind of a meditative state, which I think is sort of like what now people call alpha wave state. When your brain is generating alpha waves between 8 and 12 cycles per second, where you're kind of in a relaxed, easygoing state, you're not particularly thinking. When you're thinking, your eyes are open and you get more fast frequencies. But anyway, it's interesting that the yogis and the meditators distinguished dreaming sleep and non-dreaming sleep, because it was only in the 50s that Western psychology was able to make that distinction. And because somebody discovered, a graduate student at the University of Chicago, working in a sleep lab, they found out that rapid eye movements phenomena, that mostly when you're dreaming, people's eyeballs move back and forth. You know, REM sleep, they call REM sleep. And you wake up people when they're doing REM sleep, and they're 80% of the time they're reporting dreams. You wake them up when they're not doing REM, then they're not dreaming. So you had an external behavioral index of a subjective state. See, so then, and similarly with substances like LSD, you had an external catalyst that pretty reliably, you know, given the appropriate set and setting, could induce mystical or religious experiences that were otherwise completely unusual. You know, I use this model of the altered state, the set and setting. You have to look at the set and setting to find out what the content of the experience is. That's true of dreams, too. It's true right now in the waking state. You know, we have a certain intention, we have a certain setting. That's what else is there? It's the inner and the outer, right? So, and then you, the drug would be the catalyst. And sometimes there is no particular catalyst. You know, it's just we decide, we have the intention, or you choose to have a certain kind of an experience. Or if I'm teaching in the classroom, then I have the intention to give a lecture or give a talk, or the students have the intention to learn or discuss or ask questions like that. So, and I sometimes do this experiment in classes where I ask people to think of two positive, two altered states experiences that they'd had with or without drugs in the past year or so. One very pleasant or positive, and one not so pleasant. And to look at this, what was the set, what was the setting, and what was the catalyst? So somebody said, "Well, you know, I took this drug, and you know, I had a fight with my girlfriend, my roommate was mad at me, and it was a really bummer experience. I'll never take that drug again." You see, but after they look at the set and setting, they think, "Well, maybe it wasn't the drug. You see, maybe the set and the setting, what happened just before, had something to do with it." And often it's kind of a revelation. There's a tendency for people that even experience psychedelics and know the understanding of set and setting, still to sometimes attribute more of the effect to the drug, rather than seeing it as a catalyst or trigger. Shamanism is an ancient tradition of healing and obtaining knowledge that it goes back to Paleolithic times, hunter-gatherers, lived as hunter-gatherers, and involves going into an altered state. And the two main technologies for going into a shamanic altered states, which they don't call it altered state, they call it journey. And journey is a metaphor, and I'm very interested in metaphor. Journey is a metaphor for an altered state. It has a beginning, it has an end, it has a certain duration, and certain things happen during that duration, and you may have encounters with certain beings. And so the shaman would say, "I'm going on a journey, I got on my horse." But he has a set or intention. He goes when he's asked to do a healing on somebody in the family, or solve a problem, or find something lost. The two main technologies that are used for going into the altered state would be, one would be psychoactive plants or mushrooms, and more used in the southern hemisphere, in the tropics, in South America, Africa, and Asia. And then the rhythmic drumming, repetitive rhythmic drumming, which is more used in the northern hemisphere, Asia, North America, Europe. So, but it's always you're going into an altered state. So it helped me a lot after I had experienced psychedelic drugs and what some of the possibilities were and trying to understand them. So I mentioned using Freudian psychology didn't really help. For Jung was a bit more helpful because he's very open to religious experiences and Eastern systems. And then we studied the Tibetan Book of the Dead and Buddhism and Hinduism. And I got involved in the field of East-West psychology, which I taught here and still teach, and comparing Eastern and Western psychological approaches. In the East psychology, your psychology is always tied into your whole worldview, which is a spiritual worldview, which recognizes spiritual or transpersonal realities, and is also built in as part of a practice of developing consciousness, to a higher potential. I sometimes say what I do is shamanic psychology or shamanic psychotherapy, particularly. It differs from mainstream psychology. In the sense of, but is more like transpersonal psychology in the sense that it recognizes it's a the worldview behind the psychology is much bigger. In a shamanistic society, which is also a worldview, which is also the sometimes called animism, and it's also the worldview shared by certain esoteric and religious traditions, particularly Hinduism and Buddhism. There are many levels of reality. Well, many levels of consciousness. And in shamanism, they would say many worlds. And that we exist in. We exist at these levels so that we're multidimensional beings. The universe is multidimensional, and we're multidimensional. And there are beings in these other dimensions that have their own existence and their own autonomy that are not just figments of our imagination, or illusory creations, or dream figures, or imaginary, or even part of the collective unconscious. If you're Jungian, you say, well, it's all the collective unconscious. Religion is all the collective. God, Christ is all collective unconscious. I still have an argument with that, and I would say that that's not the shamanic approach. The shamanic approach says that all the different levels of reality are equally real. See, in the ordinary level, the ordinary worldview says only this level of reality is real. This measurable, objective, material, weighable, you drop it on your foot and it hurts kind of level is real. Everything else we say, sometimes say, merely subjective. It's psychological, so intuitions, thoughts, feelings, fantasies, all of that. And Jung did a tremendous amount by getting people to acknowledge that the psychological also has its own reality. In the shamanic worldview, you would say the other levels are equally real. One level is not more real than another. And therefore, the beings in these other levels are equally real. These beings are sometimes called spirits. Now, from a Jungian psychological point of view, we would say they're symbols or archetypes of the collective unconscious. I sometimes tell this story to illustrate the difference. Supposing I have a dream about a bear, an encounter with a bear. So I go to my psychoanalyst therapist, let's say, and he would say, well, that's symbolic of your father. You know, let's work on your father complex. I go to the Jungian, he might say, oh, that's the great mother archetype, you know, mother bear. Let's work on the mother, imago, you know, archetype, whatever that. I go to a Gestalt therapist, he would say, oh, well, it's all in your mind, right? So everything is part of your mind. So this is the bear part of your mind. Let's put the bear on a chair and have a dialogue, Gestalt dialogue with the bear part of your mind and the chair part of your mind. You see? Now, if you went to a shaman or a shamanistic psychology, that approach might not be the one that he would take, he or she would take. Because he might say, well, you had an encounter with bear, with a capital B, the spirit of bear, the god of the bear species. And to treat that being, that's a real being, it's an autonomous being. And to treat that being as if it was a symbol of something in your mind, you could be in trouble. Because it's insulting to treat a real being as if it was a symbol. It's called objectification. If I treat you as a symbol, you would be insulted. You're not just a symbol of something in my mind, you're a real being. You know, women get insulted if we treat them as a sex object that stimulates sexual fantasies, you know, rightly so. Now, the shamans would not deny that sometimes we'd have symbols and we make fantasies, of course. So part of shamanic practice is learning to tell the difference between when you're fantasizing subjectively and making things up in your mind and when you're having a real encounter from which you could derive real knowledge and real guidance. And that's incidentally what I call divination, or it's called divination. Divination means the process of obtaining knowledge from the divine world or the spirit world or other realities, higher realities, other realms of consciousness. And the two kinds of knowledge that people seek to obtain from these other realms by going into an altered state of some kind, not necessarily drug-induced, but however induced, can be just through meditation, are knowledge about the past, about healing, or related to healing or problem-solving, which is like psychotherapy. Or in shamanism, they also sometimes call it soul retrieval. You know, a part of your psyche got split off and trapped somewhere. And we want to bring it back. We want to remember it. And remembering is the opposite of dismembering. So when we've been traumatized, we've been disconnected from a part of our experience. Trauma leads to a freezing of processing, you know, often to the point of forgetting completely. Or you can have nightmares and flashbacks. And that's kind of freezing. And so then we want to retrieve that part and bring it back and remember it and integrate it into our present sense of identity. Divination, I define it as having to do with, it's a structured inquiry into intuitive sources of knowledge for healing and guidance, or guidance, past or the future. And I use the term alchemical, because alchemy is a symbol system that deals with transformation of consciousness, transformation of the person. And so I think of alchemy and yoga as the descendants of the shamanic tradition. So they would be doing alchemical experiments, working with chemical substances, and but they would also be having visionary experiences, and the chemistry, the chemical processes symbolized visionary psychological processes. And Jung discovered that, really, and formulated that. He wrote four of Jung's books, you know, were basically alchemical books, translating it or decoding it as a symbol language for psychological processes. But it was written in code because in the Middle Ages, was the dominant of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is not interested in people having spiritual experiences on their own, you know, on their own steam. Your only kind of experiences you're allowed to have are in church under the guidance of the priest and the church, and within very strict guidelines. For example, there's an alchemical operation called solutio, which means solution or dissolving. So, and the alchemist would describe it, and they would say, it's like a dissolving, you know, like you have a crystal and you dissolve it in water and turn a solid into a liquid. It's a chemical process. But they would say this is like there's a resonance, some kind of resonance principle that sets up in you. So the image of it is, there's a person sitting in a hot tub, basically. So what's he dissolving? He's dissolving, we would say in modern terms, the armoring patterns, the defensive patterns of thought, and defensive pattern of armoring, you know, what Wilhelm Reich called armoring, the muscle tensions that are dissolving, that cause conflicts, internal conflicts and difficulties and illnesses. So it's actually, like shamanism, a healing practice. The alchemical processes are healing. Well, there's a process they call separatio, which is means separation. It's dividing things up. That's like analysis. Analysis divides things up into its component parts. What's the thought that leads to this thought? And what's the thought that leads to this? And this feeling leads to that. From you divide, you know. And Jung would say you have to set apart the different ideas and images in your unconscious in order to understand them. And you give names to them and identify them. This is how you're put together. And then you put them together again, you know, but you first have to have the separatio and then the conjunctio, which is the balance of the male and female. So you have to balance with the female part in ourselves, and the male part of ourselves have to be balanced. The symbols of the king and the queen, the sun and the moon, these are all sort of cognate parallel symbolisms. So there were these different branches, the different aspects. There were some that were more focused on the actual physical chemistry, you know? And the making of gold would be one part of that, but also all kinds of chemical processes, how the elements transform into one another. The elements were earth, air, fire, and water, are the solid, liquid, gas, and electromagnetic energy aspects, you know, of life and nature and everything, and that's true. You know, you might always say there were 92 different elements, but we still have those different states of matter and energy. And then for some people, it was always the psychological aspect. In the 17th, 16th century, when the physical sciences began to separate out from the church, you know, there was a kind of a deal that was made. I write about this in my book, Green Psychology. Beginnings of the scientific worldview, the dominant worldview was the religion, the Catholic Church. You know, they controlled what was true and what's not. So when Galileo wanted to make observations through his telescope and said, well, look, there's these funny things around Jupiter, I think has moons. They said, no, you don't need to make your stupid observations. You know, we know that there are no moons around Jupiter because Aristotle would have said so, you know, or Thomas Aquinas. So. But then gradually they got to say, no, you should let us use these, you know, incredible methods, because then we can find out nature's secret and we can make a better life for everybody. So eventually, over time, kind of a deal was worked out between the scientists and the church, which was like, okay, you guys can use your methods, experiments, controlled observations. But you do it all in the material world. You stay out of the realm of spirit, consciousness, mind, quality, anything having to do with purpose, for example. You can't say anything about purpose, because purpose is all God, comes from God. Newton believed in God. Newton was actually an alchemist. Newton was an alchemist. He studied alchemical texts and wrote them for 20 years. his heirs have actually disavowed it. They've only been published in the 20th century. And Kepler, who discovered the laws of planetary motion, was an astrologer. See, astronomy and astrology used to be one science, just like alchemy and chemistry. The chemistry took only the physical part of the alchemical tradition and relegated the psychic part, the spiritual part, to the underground. And astronomy did the same thing, took only the physical measurements of the stars and relegated all the astrology, how it relates to human beings, to superstition, to the margins. So astrology never really developed beyond the astronomy of the 16th century. It deals actually with the planets and with the zodiac as it was then understood. But before that, there was an integrated science. It was an integrated worldview. Why should they be separate? It's one world, after all. It's not two different realms of knowledge, but it's become two different realms of knowledge. But now, and that part of the transpersonal movement, I think, is its great merit, because it is possible to have a scientific approach to worlds of spirit and consciousness and all that. Meaning, it's possible to be scientific, to make replicable observations, repeated observations. So marriage and, I mean, the religion and science can get, that got divorced can get married again. The one area that I'm also, besides consciousness studies that I teach in, is called ecological or eco-psychology, or I call it green psychology. And it's the psychology of our relationship to the earth, our human relationship to the earth. And you could say that that's transpersonal, but it doesn't actually even, it's not generally considered part of transpersonal. And again, that's, I think, a function of more or less an accidental function. But it is transpersonal because you're talking about how we're actually part of an ecosystem, so our identity is part of that ecosystem, not just, an individual. But mainstream psychology tends to assume, including transpersonal and humanistic, tends to assume that interesting things about, for psychologists, is what's intrapsychic or interpersonal, or intergroup, let's say, social psychology and groups, culture. But that's also true of the whole worldview. See, we have a worldview that says, well, there's the material world, or we call it the environment, and it's sort of backdrop for human beings. We still actually have the idea that human beings are superior to the natural world, which was a religious idea. It comes out of the Bible. You shall have dominion. But science adopted it uncritically and falsely. Actually, when you think about it, there's no evidence to say that human beings are superior in some kind of a way, ultimate way. I mean, you can talk about specifics, their differences. And there's a lot of research going on. Well, humans have language, can communicate. Well, people have done all these studies about animals can communicate very clearly. They don't use English words, but who said that was the only way to communicate? Even trees communicate, They communicate by pheromones and chemicals and ants and fish and all kinds of animals, birds suddenly communicate and learn, have learned behavior. And of course, we say, animals only, humans are the only ones who have consciousness. It's just stated as a statement. There's no evidence for it. It's not a scientific statement. They don't have human consciousness. Of course they don't. Why should they? But who's to say? Who's to say, right? And the traditional people, the animistic, see, animism is like, shamanism is the practice. You could say animism is the worldview. Animism says everything's animated by spirit. Anima is spirit or soul. Some people say animism means you're projecting human qualities onto nature. That's not what it is. It's perceiving the inherent intelligence, the living intelligence. What traditional people call spirits, I would call, Jungians might call symbols or archetypes. I don't say that. I said it's a living intelligence. Nature has its own intelligence. You can't just have some evolutionary idea of random mutation and natural selection. That's not enough to explain all the amazing complexities. And why should you? Believe that just out of an article of faith, Why not be open to the possibility that there is intelligent design? And it's the same thing with a shamanic view. Didn't you everything is animated, not only plants and animals, but rocks and the whole earth itself. You see, and you only have the Gaia theory that the whole earth itself is like a living organism. Well, if other living organisms have a consciousness, well, so does the earth. And then you, in fact, you have these ancient religious ideas that say, well, Mother Earth, you know, Father Sky and Father Sun and Mother Earth, and all the planets are named after deities after all. I mean, people weren't stupid. They were smart people too. They could think, they could make observations just like we can. You know, they weren't, and still do. So they're reporting their observations and saying, okay, we'll call the consciousness of the Earth, scientists are now calling the Gaia principle, or the Gaia theory, for which there's all kinds of detailed evidence, how the detailed mechanism, how it's a self-regulating, homeostatic, self-regenerating, self-maintaining, integrated system, you know, of coupled organisms with the environment, all integrated. They said Gaia, Mother Earth. I think eco-psychology, the subtitle of my book, Green Psychology, is the transformation of the relationship between humans and nature. Because what I argue, along with many other psychologists, eco-psychologists have looked at that, that the environmental crisis, the destruction of habitats, the extinction of species, all that, those things are going on. It's a human psychological problem, because it's humans that are doing it. They're not, it's not being done from Mars or outer space or accidental climate change or anything like that. It's all human. So it must be, and it's destructive, and humans see that it's destructive, and we don't seem to be able to stop it. So what is that? That's a psychological problem. You know, when you look at individual psychopathology, I have a whole chapter on what do we learn from individual psychopathology. You know, that's like an addictive behavior. And an addict is like keeps doing something that's destructive to their health, their family, their work, everything like that. They can't stop doing it. It's like that. We're addicted to fossil fuels. You know? We know it's destroying the air. And it's going to run out. And we need more and more of it. And we're like hooked on it. We don't seem to be able to stop it. It's like an addictive society. So then we look at or people like Thomas Berry, whom I like very much. He said he's a theologian who became interested in the environment and Gaia. And he says he now calls himself a geologian. And he wrote a book called The Universe Story, how the whole universe, it's kind of going back to the idea of the ancient astrologers and the ancient alchemists. It's like, okay, not only is there a material world in there, but we're part of this world, and so our psyche is affected by it and interactive with it. So we're part of the universe story. How could we not be? We don't have the possibility of assuming the position of a detached outside observer. We're right in the thick of it. We can observe and we can participate at the same time. And he says, but our civilization has become sort of autistic. He says, like, we don't seem to relate. We don't really, we're not experiencing what he called the dream of the earth. He wrote a whole book of the dream of the earth. What is the dream of the earth? Or what's the universe story? How has it evolved to come to this? Not in the sense that we're superior and we therefore have the right to lord it over. See, that's the common assumption. We're superior. We own the place, basically. It's there for us to use. Right? Resources, all resources. How can we use them? Or we might say, well, we use them for human betterment. We'll get drugs to cure cancer and all that. But the deep ecologists would say, wait a minute. Who made that law? Who made that up? They say it's anthropocentrism. It's like human-centered. It's like ethnocentrism. It's a prejudice. We're not superior. We're part of the earth. And then it turns out that the Native Americans have been saying that all along. You know, hey, we're part of the earth. It's all our relations. We don't own the place. We're not superior. There's all our relations. So we're mutually interdependency. I don't call it a systems view. Everything's interconnected and interdependent. Everything, the parts all depend on one another for the maintenance of a whole. So it's wrong for one part to say we're the rulers of this place. It's like as wrong as it would be for one organ system in the body, say the brain or the nose, to decide it's superior and it's therefore in charge of all the others and gets to use all the others. We call that disease. It's an illness. It's a planetary illness. It's what people say, the planet is ill and we've made it ill. And Lovelock even has a name for it. He says we're infestation of primates on the planet. Disseminated primatemia. It's an infestation of parasitical primates on this planet Gaia. We're sucking it dry. We're not going to kill the host. You can't kill a planet. But we're ruining large sections of it, and we're driving other species to extinction. In my classes, I try to track back, you know, what are the major turning points in which we as a civilization got so separated from the natural world? And this, I distinguish five major turning points, and many other people have written on all of this. The last one being the scientific revolution in the 16th, 17th century, which was a major, you know, the development of this materialistic worldview. And then it goes back to the beginnings of Christianity, or rather the beginnings of monotheism. Because the monotheistic traditions, all three of them, tend to have the idea of a transcendent deity, a transcendent creator deity. And transcendent means above and beyond. It's sort of out in heaven somewhere, and there's a sort of a big gap. And in Christianity particularly, the mundane world tends to be seen as devilish. You know, it's actually called the realm of the devil was called the lord of this world in early Christianity. So, and that goes along with the idea of original sin. The flesh is corrupt, you know, the material world, everything is corrupt. And to be spiritual, to be Christ-like and Christian and spiritual and after death and so on, you go to heaven. It's sort of up there beyond the material world. And that's very different, completely different from the shamanic animistic view. To them, the spiritual and the natural are the same. In the Judeo-Christian world, they're like going opposite directions. We think spiritual, we think up, heavenward. We think natural, we think down. Oh, it's down in the mud, you know, down by the feet and the stomach and the pelvis and so forth, earthly things. I use the analogy of dissociation. It's a disconnect. We lead lives of conspicuous consumption and burning oil and, you know, polluting the environment and so forth. Then we might go and but we go into nature, you know, and we go in the country by the ocean and the forest. But then we go back to our everyday life. We were participating in huge systems and corporations and so forth that are all, you know, this kind of technological destruction. The industrial technological civilization is basically destroying the earth. It's shredding the life support system of not so much human beings, it was human beings too, but all these other species of plants and animals that are being driven to extinction. That's a horrible, horrible thing. Extinction is terminal, you know, it's irreversible. You can't bring them back. It's not like killing somebody, extinguishing a species. It's such a phenomenal impoverishment of our life. So, tracing back this disconnect, so the transcendental monotheism is part of it. I'm not blaming Christianity. I'm not trying to say that. I'm not saying, as others are also not saying, Christianity is to blame for pollution or environmental destruction. They're saying these are aspects of our worldview that didn't lead us to protect the environment. Unlike, see, we think this conception of spirituality as being somehow transcendent is so ingrained in the Western worldview. It wasn't my view too until I started thinking about it and really looking at it. I always thought, well, of course, that's the way it is. You know, you go into a cathedral and your eyes are taken upward. You think of heaven as up and up in the body, like the head is more like closer to heaven than the stomach, say, or the genitals. But then you look at, you know, the worldview of Native Americans or traditional indigenous people, they don't have that at all. They say everything is animated by spirits. You communicate them, we call it Brother Bear, you know. Yeah. Sacred gods and goddesses. And similarly with the polytheistic religions, and including the polytheistic religions of our own ancestors in classical times. So the Greeks and the Romans and the Nordic people, and I wrote a whole book about Nordic European mythology, since I'm a Nordic European myself, called The Well of Remembrance. And they have all these myths and shamanic imagery of, you know, looking into the Well of Remembrance and drinking from the Well of Remembrance in order to remember your history and your connection to the earth and where you came from and your ancestry, your evolutionary ancestry. The gods and goddesses are all nature gods and goddesses. We nowadays we call them nature spirits, mountains and rivers. Sun, earth. So they have an ecological consciousness, a consciousness of reverence for the earth. If you have reverence for the earth, you regard it as Mother Earth, Goddess Mother Earth, you're going to think twice about, you know, polluting her, ruining her, gouging her out, or strip mining, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's very disrespectful. There's no guarantee, you know, that you'll have ecological consciousness and preservation. You still have to be conscious, but it certainly would look that way. The invention of the alphabet and writing, which led to the ability to make abstract concepts. And abstract concepts are separate from sensory experience. That's what it means. So they have an abstraction that's, you know, above and beyond, like transcendent. And the Greeks, Plato, had this idea of the ideal forms. You know, in the ideal world, there are these transcendental forms. Like the geometric forms, like the perfect sphere, the perfect triangle, that are perfect. They don't change, they're always a triangle, they're always perfect. And the real world is sort of an imperfect simulation or replica of that. And corruptible, it rises and falls away and dies and gets decayed and corrupt and all of that. That's sort of Greek philosophical transcendentalism was taken over by Christianity and turned into transcendental monotheism, the creator God. You know, the Greeks had polytheism. But they developed this idea that there's this realm of reality, the mental realm, essentially, as being the most real. It's an idealization of the mental realm. Shamans would not do that. They said, yes, it's one realm. But it's not the only one. You might say the emotional realm is also real, and the physical realm is also real. Well, different, but... And, for example, you had other gods. You had Apollonius, Apollo, more of a realm of mental ideals. But you had Dionysus, the realm, you know, the god of drunkenness and inebriation and intoxication and dance and music and wild excess, ecstasy. Ecstasy means ecstasis, out of the static, out of the expanded awareness outside the static realm of thinking that you previously had. So that was a big factor, which was only possible with the invention of an alphabet that allowed you to make words up. And we can have a word like consciousness. And you read in the Plato's dialogue, and Socrates will say stuff like to his students in Socratic questions, tell me about justice. And it's just about to say, well, this person was just, you know, like that. And this other person was just, give examples. And Socrates will say, no, I don't want to hear about those examples. I want to hear about justice. What's the essence of justice? It's an abstraction. Mind games. Something was lost because we had ceremonies, we had rituals, we had practices. It's not so long ago. You know, agricultural revolution is 10,000 BC. That's a very short period of time before we lived as hunter-gatherers for several hundred thousand years. Several hundred thousand years, maybe a million years or more. And so many people, including people like Brian Swim and others, say, you know, we evolved brains, hardwired brains, for a hunter-gatherer lifestyle. We haven't had time to make the switch, you know, in our thinking, in our brain, the way our brains are wired. The ecological needs to be part of the psychological. It doesn't make sense to talk about psychology. You need to look at the larger context. And you need to look at the story, which is evolutionary. The whole evolutionary cosmology. Brian Swim and Thomas Berry, what they've done, they followed, you know, many of these other scientists who said, not only does evolution on life follow an evolutionary principle, but the whole cosmos is an evolutionary progression. It starts with the Big Bang, and then you have, you know, galaxies and solar systems and planets and story. It's a story. And then you have the story of life, and then the story of human life, and then the story of your clan, your family, and then your story. And then you come to the psychologist and say, well, what's your story? You know, we all have a story, and we're embedded in larger stories. So you always want to look at the story, the evolution, the process, how we got here, and then you also want to look at the context, which is the web of life, which we're part of, not the rulers of it, not the makers of it. We didn't make it. We were made part of it. It's the technology and the misapplication of our technologies, misdirected technologies that have caused the problems that we're facing as an industrial technological society. It's like this, it's become a growth monster. It's a capitalist industrial technological system that's just turning the entire biosphere into cash and trash. Commodifying everything and selling it and generating unbelievable amounts of waste. And it's going to collapse. It's collapsing right now, even as we speak. With peak oil, oil's going to run out. Yeah, people are saying oil's going to run out within the 20 years. Oil prices are going to go up, 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 up. We've already passed the peak. There's no way of ever going back down again. Because once it's gone, it's gone. It's not renewable. That's what it means, not renewable. That means it's the engine of our civilization. That means it's gone, gone. We're living now in a time of civilizational collapse and planetary catastrophe. It's not a doom and gloom forecast. It's an observation. I don't feel bad about it. It's just, I do feel bad about it. But there's no point in, wringing one's hand and being doom and gloom. There's so much to do. There's so many things that we can do, and brilliant initiatives, inventiveness and ingenuity that people are developing, and caring, compassionate systems of living together and being together with one another and with other beings on this planet. It's all possible. It's all possible.